shattering Tem's kneecaps. The carver screamed and rolled on the ground in agony.
You shit-licking pig fucker! I'll kill you! I'll fucking kill you!
He shrieked in Igoot. His tormentor pulled over the desk chair Tem had been in minutes before and sat down. He put the Ankev down on the table and took off his cap, beating the plaster flakes from the felt. He brushed at the shoulders of his jacket, and finding that ineffective, he took the jacket off. After shaking off most of the debris, he laid the jacket over the desk on top of the gun. Then he rolled up his sleeves and waited until the stone eyes stopped screaming and lay gasping, eyes rolling with hate.
You know who I am?
You're one of those whoreson makes, Tem said.
That's right, said Maketar. And you're Tem Ben, better known these days as the Carver.
He pulled a rectangular black object from his jacket pocket. Tem saw that it was a portable cassette tape recorder, like the sort that a journalist might carry. Make wound the tape to the beginning.
You've had a good run, he said. Taking out the other two buyers on this side of town. That took some thick blood and style.
I'm a stone eye, Tem protested. The clan let G and Mr. Rowe run their business for years, and now you're gonna kill a stone eye over a little river runoff? Where's your precious greenbone coat of Aisho, you cur, you fucking louse?
Hey, if you'd stuck to buying river stones, it would have been different. Kaal Lan wouldn't have sent anyone after you, not a stone eye. Not when it might piss off the Tem family for no real gain. You take a carver off the streets, someone else fills his spot anyway, right?
Make set the tape recorder on the corner of the desk.
But now that Lan Zhen is dead and we're at war, it's time for an overdue chat. You're not just a stone-eye carver with bad Igutanian fashion sense. You're a white rat.
A white rat. A clan spy and operative. Greenbone code against murdering enemy clan members with no jade didn't apply to white rats.
My family's cut me off. I'm not part of the mountain. You can't break Aisho on a hunch.
Tem poured sweat.
Oh, it's no hunch, so don't waste your breath on denials. We've had eyes on you for months. Did you really think you could piss inside No Peak territory and that we wouldn't smell the stink?
Make peered inside Tem's satchel, rummaging through the cache and pulling out the wrapped talon knife, as if unerringly questing out the nearby jade. He unfolded the cloth and whistled.
Wartime is good for carrion eaters, obviously.
He took the knife and tested the edge with his finger, then laid it next to the tape recorder.
This can go the fast way or the slow way, but in any case, you're going to tell us everything about the mountain's activities in No Peak territory, starting with where you send all the jade you get your hands on. I've already got a pretty good inkling, but I want you to tell it for posterity, so be sure to speak clearly.
He picked up the tape machine and pressed the record button. Tem Ben spat.
Tell your master Kaal Hilo to go fuck himself.
Make's eyes narrowed into slits. He hit pause on the recorder, set it back down on the table, and picked up the talon knife instead.
The slow way it is.
Chapter 43. New White Rat.
As usual, it was past midnight when Shay returned to the Kaal house from the weatherman's office. Woon dropped her off at the front, then drove the car around to the garage. He truly was the weatherman's shadow, never leaving the tower on Ship Street any earlier than she did, acting as her near-constant bodyguard as well as her chief of staff. She'd manipulated him in a time of grief to secure his loyalty, but could not regret it, being too grateful for his expertise and the unflagging ethic he now displayed. She wouldn't have made it through a week as weatherman without him. Shay took the front steps slowly and tiredly, feeling, as she had before, a mixture of strangeness and homecoming. She'd broken the lease on her one-bedroom place and moved into the Call house before Hilo even asked her to. It was the only sensible thing to do, given the war and her position as weatherman. The Horn could no longer spare the manpower to give special protection to her apartment in North Sodo. The Call estate was secure, and living here was the only reliable way of finding the pillar when she needed to. So she'd packed her belongings, told her landlord to keep the furniture for the next tenant, then taken a last walk around the neighborhood. She'd bought a meat bun from the corner bakery and lingered to enjoy the smell. She'd admired attractive window displays along the street. She'd noticed the subtle tension and slightly faster stride of pedestrians as they passed the newspaper stand with headlines about the Klan war. Then she'd gone back to her apartment one final time and called the regional director at Standard & Croft Appliance to explain that, due to family circumstances that would no longer allow her to travel abroad for work, she was regretfully declining his offer of employment. She'd found that apartment herself. She'd gotten that job offer herself. They had been small but deeply personal victories. She hadn't lived in her apartment for long, nor had she mustered much excitement for the job, but she felt the loss of both. She couldn't move into the weatherman's house. Doru was still imprisoned inside when he wasn't spending time under guard with her grandfather. She didn't think she could ever live in that place, unless it was torn down and rebuilt to eliminate any lingering presence of the man. So ironically, she was back in her old bedroom, not that she spent much time in it. Shay paused with her hand on the front door. Stretching out her sense of perception, she could tell that her brother was not home. He had also moved into the main house so the Makes could live in the Horn's residence. It felt to Shay sometimes, when she and Hilo were both present, that they were children again, sleeping down the hall from each other, passing each other in the kitchen, their auras buzzing up against each other like live wires. Neither of them touched Lan's room.
Shay Jen.
Shay turned to see Make Wen standing on the driveway behind her. Wen was wearing a fleece robe over a loose shirt and lounge pants and beach sandals on her bare feet. She must have hurried down the connecting path when she'd seen Shay's arrival from the window of the Horn's house.
Wen, Shay said, is something wrong?
No.
The other woman came up to Shay with swift, graceful steps.
I couldn't sleep and wondered if you'd be kind enough to join me for a cup of tea.
Shay said, another time, maybe. It's been a long day, and I don't think I'd be very good company right now. She turned back to the house. Wen put a hand on her arm.
Not even for a few minutes? I always see you come home late, then sit in the kitchen with a stack of papers for another hour before going to bed. Wouldn't you like a change of scene for once? I've been redoing the house and have been desperately wanting to show it to another woman.
Shay had seen Wen come to the main house. Sometimes she was there waiting for Hilo. Sometimes she seemed to be leaving when Shay was arriving, or arriving when Shay was leaving. The two women exchanged nods or niceties in the kitchen or the hallway, but hadn't yet had a conversation of more than 20 words. More often than not, Shay found herself resenting Wen's presence. She'd squirmed while trying to fall asleep at night, struggling to block out perception of the blazing energy spill from her brother's lovemaking down the hall. The idea that Wen paid any attention to Shay's habits at all surprised her enough that she hesitated and turned toward the other woman. Wen took this as acquiescence. She gave Shay a warm, enigmatic smile and looped a hand around her arm. She seemed a physical sort, just like Hilo, always connecting through touch.
Our brothers aren't home yet. I wouldn't be surprised if they're having a drink together right now. Why shouldn't we do the same? Wen asked.
Shay told herself to be polite.
All right, since you insist.
She let Wen walk her over to the Horn's residence. They looked odd together. Wen in her robe, feet slapping in her sandals. Shay in conservative business attire, black pumps crunching on the pebble path through the garden between the houses. Wen said conversationally,
"This garden's my favorite part of the entire grounds. It's so well designed, full of variety, but not at all cluttered. And there's always something blooming no matter the time of year. At night it smells heavenly. Of course, the houses are impressive, but the garden is particularly beautiful."
Shay, who'd never paid much attention to the garden, nodded and said,
"Yes, it's nice."
Lan had enjoyed it, she knew. She kept walking, allowed the thought of her brother to run its familiar, brief course through grief and anger before she urged it to dissipate. Wen glanced at Shay.
"I didn't want to move here at first either. Hilo and I had arguments over it. My apartment in Pawpaw wasn't much, but I'd set it up the way I liked it, and I was paying the rent myself every month. To be honest, it was romantic to have Hilo coming to me in my place. I was afraid of feeling like an intruder here, worried that the family would look down on me."
She straightened slightly, lifted her chin.
"But what's the value of silly pride compared to what's doing best for the people one loves? Moving here was the right thing to do. I don't regret it at all. Though it'd be nice to have company. Everyone is out most of the time."
It was the most Wen had ever said to her, and Shay was surprised by how personal the woman was being, and how perceptively she'd picked up on Shay's own reluctance to live on the family estate. She wasn't sure if Wen was trying to empathize with her or advise her. She decided to respond simply,
"I know Hilo appreciates having you here."
They reached the lit front stoop of the Horns' house. As Wen opened the door and stepped inside, Shay couldn't help tugging her right earlobe behind the woman's back. Stone eyes weren't really bad luck, she scolded herself. They were merely genetic recessives, like albinos. Jade immunity wasn't a karmic punishment, even if Wen was a bastard, like everyone assumed she was. Nevertheless, the stigma persisted. Shay believed there was a more logical explanation for why Greenbone shunned Stone Eyes. No one liked to be reminded that Jade ability, like life itself, was a crapshoot. It was possible to have a Kekanese Greenbone bloodline behind you and still be born no better than an Abuke. Wen had indeed transformed the house. Shay remembered it had been a sour-smelling place with green shag and outdated wallpaper. Hilo's fiancé had put in bamboo flooring and bright lighting, woven rugs, and new furniture and appliances. The walls had been redone in light colors that made the space seem much larger. Shay could still smell the lingering odor of fresh paint, mingling with rose oil fragrance. The throw pillows and drapes were color-coordinated in rich burgundy and cream tones. There were decorative black rocks and white silk flowers in a glass dish on the kitchen table. Wen went into the kitchen and started the kettle boiling.
"I can't believe it's the same place."
Shay was genuinely impressed.
"I can't believe Hilo lived in it for so long with it as hideous as it was," Wen said. "Now that it's presentable, he doesn't even come over because he says it's Ken's house and he doesn't want to disrespect my older brother."
She measured rolled tea leaves into a pot, then glanced around with a shrug.
"Ken and Tar are barely here anyway, and they wouldn't care if it was a cave with straw on the floor."
Clearly, Wen had put a great deal of time and effort into renovating this house for no one's enjoyment but her own, even though she'd be moving out of it as soon as she and Hilo were married. Shay's first, snidely envious thought was, "She must have a great deal of time on her hands." And then, with chagrin, she remembered she'd promised Hilo that she'd find a new, more challenging job for Wen somewhere in the clan. She hadn't done that. Not being a high priority, the task had slipped her mind. No doubt Hilo had promised his fiancée it would happen. That must explain Wen's eagerness to talk to her this evening. Shay sighed inwardly as she took off her shoes and slid onto a bar stool at the kitchen counter.
"Hilo told me you're hoping for a job change. I've been meaning to ask around the clan to see what's available.
Things have been chaotic, as you know, but I'll get to it this week.
Is there anything in particular that you're looking for? A secretarial position in a different company?
To her surprise, Wen appeared indifferent.
My mother told me that a Stone-Eye needs to have practical, useful skills, like typing. That way I'll always be employable.
She warmed the teapot and cups with boiling water, poured off the first infusion, then poured again and steeped the tea.
Most people aren't terribly concerned about bad luck when it comes to low positions in the office that don't involve customers or large sums of money. I can type 100 words a minute, you know.
A droll smile lifted the corners of her mouth. She turned to search in the pantry.
I take it that's not what you want to do, Shay said.
Wen turned back around with a bottle in hand.
Espenian cinnamon whiskey, she declared.
She poured tea into 2 cups and added a splash of liquor into each.
It goes remarkably well with the smoky flavor of this gunpowder tea. I wondered if you'd developed a taste for Espenian drinks while you were there.
Dirt-cheap keg beer was more the speed with the student population in Winton, but Shay nodded her thanks as she took the cup and sipped, finding that Wen had been right about the flavors.
What does this woman want from me?
It was clear that Wen had something on her mind. She'd thought about Shay a lot more than Shay had thought about her. Or was Wen this perspicacious with everyone? She'd never been comfortable with Make Wen. She could put aside the fact that Wen was a Stone-Eye. More difficult was admitting that she harbored lingering resentment that it was acceptable for Hilo to be with a Stone-Eye woman, but intolerable for her to date a foreign man. If anyone had bothered to see past Gerald's Shatarian blood and Espenian uniform, they'd have learned he came from an honorable family. The Makes, though, had a bad reputation. The way Shay had heard it back at the academy, years ago Wen's mother had caused a scandal by getting pregnant and running away from her No-Peak family to join her boyfriend in the Mountain Clan. Some years later, Make Baku was accused of a grievous offense against the clan and executed. No one in No-Peak was certain what had happened over there, but rumor was that he'd murdered an influential lantern man he'd suspected of sleeping with his wife. The widow took her 2 young sons and the daughter in her womb and fled back to her relatives in No Peak, begging them to take her back in. They did so with Kal Sen's grudging permission, but the Make sons were pitied and fatherless, and when Wen proved to be a Stone-Eye, the family's disrepute was cemented. "You can't trust the Makes," Shay had overheard her grandfather say. "Impulsive and faithless on both sides of the bloodline." Hilo dismissed all of that. "Fatalistic bullshit. No one's destined to become their parents." Befriending and trusting the Makes when others wouldn't had turned out to be a great boon for Hilo. It frustrated Shay that she could never tell if her brother was calculating about these things. Did he think that marrying Wen would cement Ken and Tar's loyalty? Or had he fallen for her without considering any of that? Shay regarded the other woman. Wen was not exactly beautiful, but Shay could see why Hilo found her alluring. She had a soft but inscrutable poise, an understated presence that drew the eye without ever appearing to be asking for attention. In conversation, she had a gentle intensity, and apparently few things escaped her notice. Wen came around the counter to sit on the bar stool next to Shay. Touching Shay's knee, she asked solemnly,
"Shay-Jen, you're the weatherman. What job can you give me that would be the most helpful to the clan right now?"
Shay had not been expecting the reversal. She pressed her lips together. She didn't like being caught by a question she thought she probably ought to know the answer to.
"Helpful in what way?" she asked.
"Helpful to you and Hilo," Wen said. "Helpful in winning the war."
Shay swirled the tea in her cup.
"The war is between Greenbones."
"That's what Hilo says," Wen replied. "Though it makes no sense to shield me by saying that. If the Mountain wins, They'll kill my fiancé.
My brothers are his horn and his pillarmen, not to mention the sons of a mountain traitor.
They'll die as well.
I may be a Stone Eye, but I have everything to lose in this war, everyone I love. Should I waste the weatherman's valuable time by asking her to find me an inconsequential job photocopying and typing memos in some minor lantern man's office?
Wen raised her eyebrows.
Should I take such a job happily?
Shay thought of other women who'd inhabited the Call House. Her grandmother, her mother, Lan's wife Amy.
You're going to be the wife of the Pillar, she said to Wen. No one expects you to work, much less be part of the clan business, especially since you're a Stone Eye.
Expectations are a funny thing, Wen said.
When you're born with them, you resent them, fight against them.
When you've never been given any, you feel the lack of them your whole life.
Wen had finished her tea. She took the bottle of whiskey, poured a straight shot into her cup, and tipped it back. Shay glimpsed in a single, swift motion a hidden sharpness to make Wen. She realized she did not know the woman at all. The Pillar's future wife said,
Let me work for you, Shay-Jen, on something that'll help us win this war.
There are positions in the weatherman's office, Shay said slowly. However, I don't think you have the educational background I'd need for them.
What's the most useful role a Stone Eye can play in the clan?
Shay knew the answer. Indeed, the disquieting thought had already occurred to her. But it was a long moment before she met Wen's eyes and replied.
White rat.
Wen said,
Could you use a white rat, Shay-Jen?
The woman was leading her into dangerous territory. Shay could see that now. She followed cautiously, as if stepping through a bog. Stone Eyes could safely and discreetly handle and transport any amount of jade without exuding an aura. Unlike the Abuke, who were suspect and discriminated against, Stone Eyes blended in as ordinary Kekanese civilians. As a white rat, a Stone Eye could be very useful indeed, as a spy, a smuggler, a messenger, or a thief. Another reason to distrust them.
You're too well known, Shay said.
Only by my name, and only in No Peak. No one in the mountain knows who I am or would recognize me. They know my brothers, but I don't look like my brothers.
She was unflinching about her uncertain parentage.
Hilo would never allow it.
Never,
Wen agreed.
He couldn't know. I'd have to have another job as well, a simple one, as cover. I'm sure you could come up with something. You're willing to lie to your future husband,
Shay said, not able to mask her astonishment.
And you're asking me, as weatherman, to go against the wishes of the Pillar.
I'd be putting you in danger if I did this. Aisho would no longer protect you.
Remorse gathered in Wen's full lips and dark eyes.
Shay-Jen, did you become weatherman to please the Pillar, or to save the clan?
She smiled sadly to say she knew the answer and turned her face away, her voice falling slightly.
Hilo's brilliant as Horn. He's honest and fierce, and his men revere him. If Heart alone could win the war, we'd already be victorious. But he was never meant to be Pillar. He's not far-sighted or politically shrewd, and all the jade in the world won't change that.
She turned back to Shay, who sat nonplussed by Wen's flat assessment.
He knows he needs your help. If I can be of use to you as a white rat, I'll be doing everything I can to help the family survive.
He insists he loves me too much to let me get involved in the war in any way,
and I love him too much to obey.
It must have been at least 1 o'clock in the morning, but Shay was wide awake, and her mind had begun chewing at fearful possibilities. She looked around the renovated surroundings again, slowly. It had taken Wen a few weeks to completely change the house, to put together a skillful artifice of sights, smells, and textures, all working together to create a pleasing, polished appearance for the formerly ugly but honest residents of No Peak's most savage men. She realized now that she had misjudged Meg Wen, had seen her warm, pliable, sensual demeanor, and overlooked the green bone core beneath the stone eye stigma, forgotten that she was sister to the ferocious Meg brothers. She'd resented Wen before. Now, she was uneasy. She thought, two strong-minded women in a man's world, if they do not quickly become allies, are destined to be incurable rivals. Going around Hilo was something Shay was accustomed to, but this, she knew, he would not forgive. She'd have to think about this more and proceed carefully. Wen took Shay's empty cup from her and stood. I've taken enough of your time and kept you from sleep tonight, Shay Jen. Without shoes, Shay realized, Wen was taller than her, with curves that years of hard training had sloughed off Shay. The weatherman stood up. Thank you for the tea, Wen. We'll talk again soon. She made her way to the door and put on her shoes. The delicate fragrance of winter flowering plum blossom swept in from the garden when she opened the door. She paused in the doorway, turning back for a second as the light in the hall elongated her shadow across the stoop of the Horn's house. I think, she ventured, that it's possible my brother has better taste than I've given him credit for. Wen smiled. Good night, sister. Chapter 44 Return to the Goody Two. Barrow thought about the tunnel beneath the Goody Two. He thought about it a lot, and whenever he thought about it, he was filled with bitter rage. John Loon was at war over the death of Kaal Lan, his doing, and there was jade being won and lost on the streets every day, but Barrow was nowhere nearer to a single pebble of it for himself. Instead, he'd been forced to flee and hide, like a roach before a bright light. He hadn't fled far. After stumbling through the darkness for what felt like an eternity, wondering with each step when his flashlight batteries would run out and leave him to wander blind until he collapsed and died, Barrow had felt a breeze on his face, a faint air current pungent with the smell of the harbor, sea salt and boat fumes, fish and wet garbage. The breeze preceded a distant circle of evening light, which Barrow ran toward as if running toward his own dead mother. As Moot had promised, the tunnel led out under an escarpment near the wharfs of Summer Park. In heavy spring rains or a summer typhoon, the tunnel would flood, but in the dry winter season, it was an excellent smuggler's passage. Dirty and exhausted, Barrow paid for passage on a small private ferry, but he did not take Moot's advice to flee far from John Loon. For weeks, he'd lay low on Little Button. The island was only 45 minutes away by ferry boat, and it wasn't officially part of John Loon, though on a clear day, Barrow could see the city from across the strait. Little Button was its own municipality. For centuries, there'd been a Deitist monastery here, before the Shatarians had turned it into a labor camp. And now it was a touristy sort of place with a restored Deitist temple, a nature preserve, and a quaint town full of little shops selling overpriced knick-knacks and handmade items. Barrow hated it. It was, however, a good place not to be recognized. Full of John Loon day-trippers and foreign visitors, it was easy enough to get a motel room and nurse the injuries to his body and his pride in glum solitude, watching television, eating takeout food, and plotting his return to the city. Little Button was run by a minor clan family that was a tributary of the mountain, but from what Barrow gathered, it was largely left alone by the John Loon clans. Just to be safe, he moved to a new motel every week, so no one would start noticing him. From the news, Barrow knew that the city was a patchwork of street violence, and there were parts of John Loon where it wasn't clear which clan was in charge, if any. The mountain had taken a good chunk of the docks, but No Peak still held the armpit and had conquered much of Sogan. Fishtown was anyone's guess. Barrow had been gone for more than a month. In all this chaos, surely no one was still looking for him. On a clear morning, he went down to the marina and took the ferry back across the strait. Barrow blamed Moot and the goateed Greenbone for his situation. They'd set him up. They'd promised him jade and then reneged on him. They'd never intended to bring him in. The more Barrow thought about it, the angrier he grew. Also, he thought about the tunnel under Moot's store and the hidden boxes he'd been too hurried and panicked to inspect or steal. Again, he kicked himself. All his misfortunes came from haste. What was in those boxes? He knew where to get the jade that was rightfully his, from Moot himself. He didn't have the Fullerton anymore, which was a shame, but he had plenty of money. And although civilian ownership of handguns was technically illegal in John Loon, conditions of disorder in a clan war ensured that the street sale of them was common. It took Barrow one afternoon in the mountain-controlled side of the docks to get his hands on a decent revolver. His plan was to hold Moot's son hostage at gunpoint until Moot paid with his jade. If that didn't work, he would kill Moot and take the jade. An unexpected sight met his eyes when he got to the Goody Two that evening. The store was dark, and the building was boarded up. The store's large banner had been torn down, and there was no sign of anyone in or around the place. Barrow wandered up to the window suspiciously and peered through. It was a mess inside. The place had been ransacked. Shelves were empty, and fixtures were tipped over. Most of the merchandise was gone, but what remained was scattered on the ground and already picked through. Useless stuff, like old magazines and sun hats. Barrow kicked the front door and jiggled the padlock angrily. He looked around. The street was empty. This part of town was so close to the border between Junco and Spearpoint that apparently no one in their right mind wanted to be loitering in it. He pounded the sidewalk-facing windows, which shook in their frames. A homeless man on the corner, the only other person in sight on what was typically a busy intersection, called out,
"Haven't you heard? Moot's dead, KK!"
Barrow turned around.
"Dead? Who killed him?"
The man grinned a toothless grin from under his blankets. He shrugged and giggled.
"He did! Walking around with jade, you're killing yourself!"
Barrow found a heavy rock and broke one of the Goody Two's windows. It made a god's-awful amount of racket, but there was no one but the hobo nearby to take notice. As Barrow kicked in the glass and climbed gingerly into the ruined store, he was fuming with a peculiar mixture of disappointment and hope. So Moot was gone, and his jade with him. Someone had beaten Barrow to it. That was just to be expected, wasn't it? Always, something would happen. Fate would shine on him, it would dangle what he desired, then it would snatch it away. Lucky and unlucky, that was him. And now, maybe bad luck would turn to good again. Maybe. Maybe. The closet in the back of the store was open. The drawers of the wheeled filing cabinet were open and the contents pulled out and dumped in the mad search for cash and valuables, but the thing itself hadn't been moved. His heart in his throat, Barrow leaned his weight against it and pushed it out of the way. He felt around in the dark to find the break in the carpet. When he rolled it back, he found the trap door he'd escaped through 5 weeks ago. Barrow closed the door of the closet and blocked it with the filing cabinet. He pulled the chain of the single bulb overhead, flooding the small space with yellowish light. Barrow tugged at the metal ring of the trap door. It lifted with a heavy scraping sound and a small cloud of dust. Queasy with anticipation, he descended warily down the steps into the tunnel. It was still there, boxes and crates, untouched by the scavengers who'd torn through the rest of the store. Barrow took one of the top boxes and set it on the steps. He cut the packing tape with a pocket knife and gaped at what he'd found. Then he stared back at the small tower of containers. How had Moot hoarded all of this? Surely it hadn't all come from the goateed Greenbone, who'd only brought him the one small box that first night Barrow had seen him. Moot must have been a dealer. A grin spread across Barrow's face as he pulled one of the small sealed bottles out of the open carton in front of him. Shine. A lifetime supply of shine. All of it now his. His hands shaking with eagerness, Barrow scooped up as many vials as he could fit into his pockets. Then he replaced the half-empty box on top of the others, and with an avaricious backward glance, climbed back out of the tunnel into the store. He dropped the trap door into place, rolled the carpet over it, and moved the filing cabinet back to exactly where it had been over the entrance to the secret tunnel. Barrow turned out the closet light and stepped back out into the demolished store, his pockets laden and his mind galloping. This building would probably be taken over by someone else soon. He would have to move his treasure trove to somewhere safe that he could more easily access. A noise behind him and a flashlight beam falling across his shoulders made Barrow jump and whirl in the dark. He scrabbled for his revolver and brought it up to the face of a boy, 13 or 14 years old. Moot's son.
"What are you doing here?"
Barrow shouted.
"I thought you might be him, coming back for me."
The boy's voice was high and strained. He held a cheap folding talon knife in his fist. His knuckles were white on the handle. The flashlight beam stayed on Barrow as the two of them stared at each other.
"Who's coming back for you?"
Barrow's finger hugged the trigger of the revolver. He didn't want this kid telling anyone he was back in the city, or getting the idea that his dead father's store of shine belonged to him instead of Barrow. The junior Moot trembled, shaking the weak flashlight beam, but there was wild hatred in his voice as he spat.
"Make! He killed my da! Make Tar killed my da, and if it's the last thing I do, I'm gonna kill him!"
Tears sprang into his eyes. Barrow's finger was still curled, but now he hesitated. Slowly, he lowered the revolver.
"It's hard to kill a really powerful Greenbone," he said. "I don't care! I'll do whatever it takes!"
Both the flashlight and the talon knife dropped to the teenager's side, and he stood, nearly panting, glaring at Barrow with flushed cheeks and maddened eyes, as if daring him to say otherwise.
"I've done it before," Barrow told him with a thrill of pride. "I've killed a Greenbone. No one figured I could do it, but they were wrong. All of them."
The other teen's eyes widened with greedy curiosity. Whenever he'd seen the younger Moot before, Barrow had paid him little attention. He'd always seemed obedient and unremarkable. He was skinny, and his hair was greasy, and his face had a rat-like quality. But he wasn't as much of a pussy as either Sampa or Cheeky had been. It wasn't good to do things alone, Barrow decided. Fate was like a tiger encountered on the road. Best to divide its attention. When things had gone most wrong for Barrow, someone smaller and weaker had always been there to draw the bad luck to themselves.
"I'm not scared of Greenbones," Barrow said. "They're the ones who are scared of us, you know. They killed your da because they're afraid of people outside the clan having jade. What we need is some jade of our own, KK." "Yeah," said Moot fiercely. "Yeah, that's right. And I know where to get it."
Moot's flashlight beam came back up.
"You do?"
Chapter 45. A Shared Joke. Hilo surrendered his weapons to one of the uniformed Greenbone guards standing at the entrance to Wisdom Hall. The guard was a young woman, whose jade aura hummed with intense concentration as Hilo approached.
The members of Hado Shield were purportedly trained to an especially high level of perception to detect signs of murderous intent. She would have to relax her standards for perceived hostility if she was going to let anyone into the building today, Hilo thought, smiling to himself as he unstrapped his moonblade, unbuckled his talon knife, and unholstered his gun, placing them side by side on the table in front of the metal detector. It wasn't that he doubted the guard's abilities or didn't understand the sentiment behind leaving weapons outside the negotiating chamber, but both were pointless measures. There was plenty of jade being collectively carried into the room on people's bodies. The green bones in attendance could easily kill each other barehanded if negotiations broke down. They would not, though, not with a penitent in the room, and there were three of them present in the meeting chamber where the mediation between the clan leaders was scheduled to take place. Apparently, the council thought it wise to arrange triple the spiritual insurance. The penitent stood quietly in the corners of the room, one man and two women, their shaved heads bowed and hands folded in the sleeves of their long green robes. Acts of violence were forbidden, not just in any deity's temple, but anywhere a penitent was present. They were in direct communication with heaven, so the belief went. The gods would know who had gone against the divine virtues and struck first. Heaven's spies, as it were. Not only would the sinner's soul be damned, but on the day of the return, his entire family line, ancestors, parents, children, and descendants, would be refused entry into heaven and be forced to wander the empty earth in exile for all eternity. Yesterday, Hilo had suggested to Shay that it would be worth risking whatever theoretical metaphysical reckoning would befall them in the afterlife if the two of them could kill Ait Mata right where she sat across the table from them. Shay had turned a stunningly cold look on him. "The gods are cruel, Hilo," she said, as if she knew them personally. "Don't tempt them with arrogance." There were two doors in the chamber, so he and Ait did not even enter through the same hallway. Hilo went into the room and sat down in the end chair, nodding to the dozen members of the royal council who lined either side of the table and comprised the official mediation committee. They looked officious in dark suits and held expensive pens over yellow legal pads in leather folios. Four of the committee members belonged to No Peak: stern-looking Mr. Vang, white-haired Mr. Loyi, horse-faced Mrs. Nur, and smiley Mr. Kowi, who had a head shaped like a turnip. Hilo recognized each of them on account of Woon's briefing the previous evening. The diligent former pillarman was proving to be a great asset in the weatherman's office. Hilo was glad to have spared his life. He did not blame Woon for Lan's death, no more than he blamed himself, but it was good to see the man turn his remorse into effort for the clan. Of the other politicians in the room, four were loyal to the Mountain. The remaining four were not clan-affiliated. Hilo hadn't even known there were councilmen who had no clan allegiance, ones who might be bought. "There are 14 independents, plus two beholden to minor clans, out of 300, Shay had enlightened him. "Try to remember these things." The seat at the other end of the table was empty. Ait had not arrived yet. Hilo checked his watch. He leaned back in his chair and smiled at those assembled, apparently at ease as he waited. "Ait Chen must have stopped to key my car." A nervous chuckling from some around the table. Mr. Loyi half-smiled, and Mr. Kowi laughed out loud, but Vang and Nur looked unimpressed. Most of the people in the room, regardless of clan, regarded Hilo with a mixture of nervous respect and cloaked disdain. They didn't know what to make of the wolfish young pillar. Hilo didn't particularly care for them either. Puppets behind puppets. In the seat slightly behind and to the left of him, Shay's aura grew a little louder in his mind, and she wrapped a pen on the arm of her chair, as if in a warning reminder that they were here to improve their standing with the council, not worsen it. Silence descended abruptly over the room. The politicians that had been chatting quietly noticed and straightened back to the table expectantly. It took Hilo a second to realize that the change was in reaction to him. He had gone entirely still, his gaze resting unfocused on some middle distance as his perception stretched beyond the walls. Ait Mada and her weatherman had entered the building and were making their way toward the room. His enemy's jade aura was dark, dense, and molten, like lava flowing inexorably closer, building in heat. It exuded a calm, unrelenting malice directed unmistakably at him, and as she could no doubt perceive him where he sat, the intensity of their long psychic stare was such that Hilo felt there was almost nothing left to say by the time Ait entered the room a minute later. Everything that was going to happen today had already happened. The rest would be meaningless talk. As he had expected, Ait's physical appearance was of little note in comparison to the impression left by her aura. She was dressed in black with a cream-colored blazer and wore no handbag, jewelry, or makeup. She strode in, apparently faintly amused by the waiting crowd, and settled into the chair opposite Hilo at the other end of the table. Short, slick-haired Ree Tura took the seat behind her left shoulder.
"Good afternoon, councilmen," Ait said.
"Ait Chen," the politicians beholden to the mountain nodded in her direction. They paid her respect, that much was clear, more than the no-peak councilman paid to Hilo, whose lips twitched slightly, his eyes still fixed on the other pillar. With Ait's entry, the room changed. Where there had been a business-like anticipation, now there was a tension preceding something inevitable. The air held the quality of a taut bowstring, of the blade before it falls, of the space between hammer and pin. Even the suits in the room with no ability in perception sensed it easily enough. The chair of the committee, a woman named Onde Patanya, who was one of the few independent council members, was brave enough to stand up and start the meeting. She cleared her throat.
"Respected Greenbones and fellow members of the Royal Council, we meet in Wisdom Hall today in good faith and in the spirit of the divine virtues under the watchful eye of the gods,"
she glanced meaningfully at the penitents in the corners,
"and under the auspices of his heavenship, Prince Eowyn III.
She inclined herself toward the portrait of the sovereign on the wall. "May he live 300 years, the room murmured in dutiful chorus. Hilo quelled a smirk as he glanced at the oil painting on the wall. It depicted a stately, heavy-browed young man in the traditional long-robed garb of Kekanese nobility, sitting on a wide, cushioned chair, with one hand resting on the sheathed moonblade across his lap, and the other holding a fan of palm fronds, representing the monarch's role as warrior and peacemaker. It was an archaic symbolism. The moonblade was traditionally a greenbone weapon. Hilo was quite certain the prince had never drawn a real one. Members of the Kekanese royal family were forbidden from wearing jade, an edict codified in the national constitution after the throne was re-established following the Many Nations War and the independence from the Empire of Shatar. Hilo had seen the prince, who was considerably less majestic in real life, during public festivities at New Year's and other major holidays, and there was a large framed photograph in the Call House of the monarch bestowing Hilo's grandfather with some royal honor for national service. Prince Eowyn III was popular as a symbol of Kaycon's unity and history, but he was a figurehead, a man who lived a comfortable, state-funded life of ceremonial duties. His splendid portrait was in the room, but he was not. He merely gave his blessing to the Royal Council, which represented the people and passed the laws. 95% of the council members held clan affiliation and were funded by powerful lantern men who were themselves tributaries of the clans. Real power in John Loon, and by extension the entire country, rested in the clans, in the two pillars whose hatred for each other pervaded the length of the room like a pungent odor.
"Let me begin," said Councilwoman Onde, "by applauding Eitjen and Kaljen and their weathermen for taking the important step of being here and signaling their willingness to resolve differences through negotiation instead of violence. I speak on behalf of the entire Royal Council in expressing my sincere hope that we will soon reach an agreement that will return our city to a state of peace. We are scheduled to meet here for 5 days, but all of us on the committee are committed to staying as long as necessary to assist in reaching an agreeable outcome. Of course," Onde put in with an optimistic smile, "if we conclude early, all's the better."
Hilo thought glumly about all the time that would be wasted, time in which he was kept away from the critical battles that were being fought throughout the city. While he was in here, Ken was in sole command of the war, and while Hilo had faith in his horn, he would be deluding himself not to admit that Gaunt outclassed the Makes as a strategist and fighter. Ike could afford to sit here. Hilo could not.
"We'll begin with an opening statement from each side," said Onde. "By coin toss, the mountain will proceed first. Eitjen."
She sat down and picked up her pen. Ike let a pause settle, just short of uncomfortable, before she said, in a clear, even voice that reminded Hilo of an academy lecturer,
"I'm deeply saddened that the rift between the two great clans of this country has led to bloodshed. However, my father, let the gods recognize him, impressed upon me the responsibility that Greenbones hold to protect and defend the common people. When those who depend on us for protection are threatened, we have no choice but to respond."
She held out a hand to her weatherman, who immediately placed a sheet of paper in it.
"For some time now, no Peak's overly aggressive tactics have harmed respectable citizens and businesses. For the enlightenment of the committee, Regen has listed merely a few examples."
Ait glanced at the paper in her hand.
"Construction on the Reign of Luck Casino was delayed for 3 months due to sabotage, which was explicitly ordered by the Horn of No Peak at the time."
Hilo listened silently to Ait's extended list of grievances. He kept his expression mild and unchanged, but impatience and anger built inside of him. He could reply to every single one of the accusations. Yes, he'd ordered his fists to disrupt the construction of the Reign of Luck Casino, but only because the building contract had been outright stolen from No Peak. Yes, he'd allowed his men to cripple those three mountain fingers because they'd vandalized and terrorized a string of No Peak properties. Ait went on with an accounting of old sore spots, some stretching back 2 years or more, none of them material to the war now. When Ait finished, Councilwoman Onde thanked her and reminded everyone there ought to be no discussion until No Peak had had a chance to respond. Onde turned to Hilo and asked if he was ready to make his opening statement. For a moment, Hilo considered declining the invitation and leaving the circus before it could continue, but Shay loudly rustled the paper she reached forward to place on the table beside him. Hilo glanced down at it. The weatherman and her shadow had prepared different speeches depending on what strategy Ait employed. Whether she began with grand statements, specific demands, or vague accusations. Hilo picked up the paper. "I'd like to applaud and thank the Royal Council for recognizing the need for this meeting. As active citizens and members of the community, we Greenbones want peace and prosperity for John Loon as much as anyone else." The words sounded stilted and unnatural in his mouth, and he skipped over some of the speech. Does Shay really expect me to say all this?
He continued reading, reciting a list of No Peak's opening demands of the mountain. Withdrawal from the docks, surrender of the armpit, cessation of SN1 production, and consent to being subject to an outside inspection of financial records and jade inventories. The last one was so outrageous that Hilo had to fight a smile at Ri Tura's look of outrage, though Ait herself seemed unsurprised and didn't react.
"Thank you, Kaljen," said Councilwoman Onde. "I am encouraged by the clarity and forthrightness expressed by both pillars in their opening statements. A solid basis upon which to build our discussion."
Onde was likely one of the only individuals in the room to think this could be true. The clan-affiliated politicians on both sides of the table appeared more nervous after hearing the superficiality of the speeches, sensing it to be a sign that their pillars had already come to an understanding without words.
"As the issue of territorial jurisdiction is the most pressing in terms of contributing to the ongoing street violence, I suggest we begin there," Onde said brightly.
After several hours, Ait made a show of conceding that the mountain would hold its position south of the General's Ride and not press further into the docks or the Junko District. In exchange, Hilo stated to the council that there would be no further attacks on Fishtown or Spearpoint. Meaningless agreements. The mountain couldn't push further into the docks. Hilo knew they didn't have the manpower. Just like he knew No Peak couldn't hold Fishtown or Spearpoint, even if he went after them. Neither district was particularly valuable anyway. The Armpit and Sogan were the worst battlegrounds, and there'd been no movement toward agreement in either. Ken was installed with 80 warriors in Sogan right now. Tellingly, no mention had been made by either side of the assassination attempt on Hilo, the murder of Lon, or the massacre of 21 mountain greenbones on Poor Man's Road. A room in Wisdom Hall was not where those grievances would be accounted for. Hilo stared across at Ait as they both stood up to leave. This is a joke. A joke we're sharing. The second day of negotiations did not progress much further than the first. During one of the 15-minute breaks, Hilo took his weatherman aside.
"This is an orgy of pigs and shit," he said. "A complete fucking waste of time.
If we walk out now, it'll look like we broke off negotiations, and No Peak will be held at fault for continuing the war," Shay insisted. "The way those suits in there see it, the mountain took Lon, and we took from the mountain in return. In their minds, that settles the blood score between the clans, and we ought to talk the rest of it out and get back to life as normal."
She cut him off before he could reply with any derisive exclamations.
"Remember why we're here. We need to show the Lantern Men and the Royal Council that we made an effort at peace. The way Ait is stonewalling, we'll have their sympathies when we lay everything out on the last day."
Shay had obtained early results of the formal audit on the KJA, and she planned, on the fifth and final day, to use them as leverage against the mountain, and failing that, to disclose them and make it clear to the council that the war was about far more than clan vendettas, that the mountain's actions went against Kekanese law and values. Hilo admitted that it was not a bad plan. Either they would come away with enough concessions to put them in a tenable military position until spring, or they would hold the moral high ground, and thus, hopefully, the support of the clan's lantern men and the public. Nevertheless, Hilo felt all these things were ancillary factors. They would not substantially change the outcome of the war, and he chafed at the task of playing through this farce for the benefit of the spectators. He returned to his place in the room. It was growing increasingly infuriating to perceive the smugness of his opponent's thick jade aura, to catch the occasional twitch of amusement on her lips. They were in on this together, the placating and assuaging of the politicians and the businessmen,
the self-importantly modern Kekanese who liked to tell themselves that there was no need to solve disputes in the old way, the way of the clean blade under the judgment of old uncle, a belief both pillars knew to be false.